Prayers for anxiety, assurance, forgiveness, plagues, sickness. The Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for April contains more than 500 prayers that cover almost any situation. It's titled Lutheran Prayer Companion. Browse before you buy at issuesetc.org or find out more and purchase Lutheran Prayer Companion by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. The Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for April, Lutheran Prayer Companion.
And I encourage you to use this time at home to get back in the Word, read our Bibles, and spend time with our families.
I would vote for him this time for just one reason, because he has been stuffing the U.S. federal courts with serious, conservative, believing judges.
While we are in this time of exile, it may be that some of these gifts of God are not able to be received as regularly as we would like.
We are sinful, okay? And it's not a minor blemish. It's not like, oh, too bad, otherwise we're pretty good. No, there's a deep, utter corruption. This is a God-sized problem. You can't fix it.
Taiwan de Xinjiao Shi and I Ting Issues, etc. That Taiwan missionaries love Issues, etc.
Two headlines recently in the New York Times. The first one, the road to coronavirus hell was paved by evangelicals. That headline has since been changed a little bit. And the other, Florida pastor arrested after defying virus orders. Talking about Rodney Howard Brown. He defied the orders of not only stay home, but also how many people could assemble. He assembled a lot of people at his church, and the sheriff of his county, I believe, arrested him for it. So what's the difference between these two headlines and the two subjects? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. Live on this Wednesday afternoon, April the 1st. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Terry Mattingly will join us for the first half hour. We'll talk about a New York Times story about the arrest of a Pentecostal megachurch pastor holding worship services during coronavirus. Then Dr. Ken Sherb joins us to think about and perhaps maybe start our thinking on the church post-coronavirus. Terry Mattingly is a regular guest. He's senior fellow at the Overby Center at the University of Mississippi. He's author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion. He's also founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
What do we need to know about this piece in the New York Times originally headlined, The Road to Coronavirus Hell Was Paved by Evangelicals?
Well, first of all, I have to ask right back, how many people sent you a URL to that piece in the New York Times? Can you even estimate?
Well, I saw it everywhere. In fact, post after post after post in long rows.
Right. And here at, you know, Get Religion Central in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, let's just say that I lost count of the number of people who sent me things about that. And the first thing that we need to talk about when dealing with that headline is that this is obvious to us because of what we discuss here all the time, but it's still not obvious to the American people. This was not a news story. And it was an op-ed page piece. And it was an op-ed page piece. I mean, far be it from me to defend the New York Times, and I thought that was a horrible headline, and they've changed it now. We'll get to that change in a second. But this is the same op-ed page piece that within about a 24 to 36 hour period ran a wonderful op-ed by Russell Moore of the Southern Baptist Convention on why evangelicals should care about this issue and cooperate with this issue and do everything they can to help their neighbor, you know, by stopping the spread of coronavirus. So do we want to be mad at the New York Times for running one of those op-eds? Oh, yeah. Heck yeah. Do we want to be happy about the other? Yes. But how many liberals out there do you think were mad about a Southern Baptist Convention person being put in a good light on the op-ed page of the New York Times? A lot. I can assure you, a lot. But these were editorial pieces. Now, the actual editorial piece itself, which now has this headline, the religious right's hostility to science is crippling our coronavirus response. Well, what happened in that headline? First of all, the headline which, of course, writers do not write their own headlines. That's another principle we've got to get our people to understand. Very, very rarely does a reporter or essayist get to write the headline that's on top of their piece. This one way better reflects the contents of the article. And there are parts of the article that you might want to argue about, but it really is more of an article about politics and about a certain niche in the American conservative Christian spectrum. Maybe it's a little bit too oversimplistic, but the religious right is a thing. I also liked the fact that religious right is a term that's used to describe kind of an older generation of cultural conservatives. And I happen to think that we can still argue about some of the contents, but I happen to think that that's more accurate. It's a much better headline to describe what this woman, who's the author of a book, Catherine Stewart, is the author of a book called The Power Worshippers, Inside the Dangerous Rise of Christian Nationalism. And we've got all kinds of things in there. But the first headline, evangelical, is a word we would like people to use to describe religious, doctrinal, and church-related subjects, issues, beliefs, behaviors, etc. Now, you and I have talked plenty of times about how hard it is to define evangelical and the fact that so many people now just assume the word evangelical means Republican, you know, etc., and that they just think there's only one kind of evangelicals and all evangelicals love Trump and all that other stuff. Evangelical is not a precise word, and it's not the best word to use on top of that op-ed. So I didn't think the op-ed was as bad as a lot of people thought it was. I disagreed with large parts of it. I thought parts of it, as did Rod Dreher, also thought that parts of it had some substance worth discussing. But the headline infuriated me in the sense that it's fun to plug in another religious group and write a similar headline. Write a headline about Jewish people or Muslim people, or as Rod did, write a headline about gays and lesbians that's that simplistic and see how many letters you'd get. So the big thing there is that it wasn't a news story. Now, we can jump from there right on to an important piece, which I wrote about today, about this case unfolding down in Florida with Rodney Howard Brown, a guy with a long history, which the Get Religion writer Julia Dean wrote a piece early this week about her history with this guy and, you know, and kind of his wilder past. And this guy is not even a good signature leader for charismatic Pentecostal Christians, let alone evangelicals, let alone megachurches of all kinds, etc. And so I began seeing stories that made it sound like Rodney Howard Brown, with his congregation that's continuing to meet and hold services, and, you know, initially he was having them shake hands and hug each other because we're here to raise up real Christian believers, not pansies, and all this other wild stuff that he was saying. Sure enough, this got him arrested, which raises another issue. How will the New York Times newsroom, not the op-ed page, how will the newsroom describe this guy? Which gets us into the fact that this ends up being a story that wasn't nearly as bad as it could have been, and wasn't as bad as some other stories that I saw about the same arrest. So does that help so far?
Yes. So just a real quick question. How do you account for the fact that the New York Times can be so good at some things and so absolutely terrible at others?
I've come to the conclusion, it started off basically being about religion linked to the sexual revolution. You know, my theory on this is that so much of this modern era of media bias studies has to begin with Roe v. Wade. And then the further we got into the sexual revolution era, the more other issues got attached to that. And in the most part, because this is where religion intersects with public policy and public life. And the famous example that you and I have talked about many times with Bill Keller, the thing that led to the Get Religion term Kellerism, which was soon after he resigned as editor of the New York Times, he was asked, is the New York Times a liberal newspaper? And he said, well, I think we play it straight on politics, but there are some cultural issues, he said, you know, on which we are a progressive, urban, tolerant newspaper. And what a wonderful combination of words that is. A progressive, tolerant, urban, sophisticated, as opposed to knuckle-dragging folks out in Jesus land. You know, it would be the harsh way of stating the opposite of that. If you'll remember in that interview in Austin, Keller said that, he said, you know, aside from things like gay marriage and creationism, aside from that, aside from religion and cultural, he didn't say religion, he said cultural issues and of that kind, I think we are still a balanced and fair newspaper. The column I wrote when this he first said this was, you know, so what are the issues that divide America right now, that most divide us? They are almost all linked to that intersection of religion and culture. So basically, he was saying, I think we do a great job, and we're upholding journalistic values, except when it comes to all that religion and culture stuff, which right now is about half of American politics. You then throw in Donald Trump into the equation, and I would argue that on a lot of their basic political coverage, the New York Times is now an advocacy publication, you know, much like we have the advocacy commentary of Fox News at night versus the advocacy commentary on MSNBC and CNN at night. We're moving, alas, and I think this is horrible, it's one of the things tearing America apart, we're moving further and further into this era of niche-oriented advocacy journalism, with news consumers all over America hiding in their concrete silos so that they don't have to listen to each other. And that's why that New York Times op-ed about the road to hell being paved with evangelicals, coronavirus hell, a specific hell being paved by evangelicals, that's like a dog whistle to the current majority, and I'm going to stress majority, not all, a majority of New York Times loyal readers and people who consider the New York Times to be gospel. But what I just danced with right there was the kind of simplistic statement that I was most worried about with this situation with Ronald Howard Brown. I was worried that the New York Times was going to make this guy stand for evangelicalism again, or even make him stand for kind of megachurch Christianity, when his church really isn't all that large, if you know anything about the size of American megachurches, where if you look at the, just a while ago, I looked them all up, the top 25 largest megachurches in America start with memberships of about 15,000 and up to 40,000, which is like South Korea size. And that, of course, is Joel Osteen, you know, in the former NBA arena in Houston. So I was worried that they were going to paint this guy as typical of evangelicalism, and quietly toward the bottom, they didn't in this new news piece that has come out about his arrest. And tucked away at the bottom of this thing, after a pretty good, one-sided but pretty good discussion of First Amendment issues here, is shutting down his church a violation of their First Amendment rights. That's a very serious issue that we should talk about. You basically had a gentle reminder toward the end that, you know, there's another megachurch in, you know, the same area near his church that are cooperating freely. And they never said, all across America, evangelicals are rebelling against orders to close their churches. It didn't make the simplistic statement that I feared. At the top of the post I wrote today, I tried to turn this into a principle, because with so many of the things, Todd, that you and I talk about, we see patterns repeated over and over and over again. And the way I put it, I will use evangelicals in this equation since the most common religious flock mentioned in this is the most common religious flock mentioned in these missives. But you can see this equation play out with Catholic voters, Jews and Israel, New Yorkers, Democrats, and lots of other niches in public life. And I'm talking about where we just say Catholic voters are swinging to Trump. Well, that's too simplistic a statement. You know, Jews base their decision on policy about Israel. They all do? What percentage of them do? What percentage of Orthodox do? What percentage of liberal Jews do? This tendency to assume that there is a monolithic block called evangelicals, or even a monolithic block called megachurches, is exactly the principle that we're trying to avoid here. And I was surprised the New York Times didn't go there in this story. There's a lot of things about the story. Once again, I would tweak or do slightly differently, but it didn't put all evangelicals in rebellion against shelter-at-home laws, and that more churches, it could have said the overwhelming majority of churches in America are cooperating with shelter-in-place orders. But that would have required more reporting, and sometimes maybe in this day and age, reporters don't have the time for that.
Terry Mattingly is our guest. We're talking about a New York Times story about the arrest of a Pentecostal pastor for holding worship services during the coronavirus outbreak. When we come back, we will talk about the First Amendment. Stay tuned.
The Simply Classical curriculum for special needs moves at my child's pace and gives her exactly what she needs. So writes Amber, a homeschooling mother who has joined thousands in homes and schools teaching from this uniquely Christian classical approach to special education. Teach students with autism, learning disabilities, or Down syndrome based on ability level rather than chronological age. Use promo code LPR20 today at classicalspecialneeds.com. Classicalspecialneeds.com.
Listen to the best of the church's music for the season of Lent at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the season of Lent, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Smartest listeners in radio, you're listening to Issues Etc.
The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod celebrates and affirms life from the time of conception until natural death, and every time in between. For this reason, LCMS Life Ministry is a program singularly devoted to upholding the sanctity of human life, both in our church body and the culture at large. Life Ministry provides educational materials, hosts conferences, and works closely with allies such as Lutherans for Life. For more information, visit lcms.org/life and follow LCMS Life Ministry on Facebook.
Concordia University Chicago is committed to keeping college affordable for all, and especially for LCMS Lutherans. We have scholarships available specifically for students who are LCMS members. This is Dr. Russell Dawn, president of Concordia Chicago, asking you to encourage your student to check out Concordia Chicago at cuchicago.edu. And if you are interested in supporting these scholarships, please find us online at foundation@cuchicago.edu.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking with Terry Mattingly, a senior fellow at the Overby Center at the University of Mississippi, author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion. He's founder and editor of Get Religion. We're talking about a New York Times story about the arrest of a Pentecostal pastor for holding worship services during coronavirus. Terry, you wanted to discuss the Rodney Howard Brown story vis-a-vis the First Amendment.
Yeah, this is a classic example of something potentially in church-state law. I wish I could point readers to a brilliant essay about this written by David French, written yesterday for the Dispatch, but it's behind a paywall. So it's kind of hard to point toward it. But the principle here is often articulated as bad facts make for bad decisions or bad law. And what he's really worried about is that a few megachurch pastors in America could end up creating a standoff over the First Amendment at the time of this pandemic that gives us some sort of bad court decision somewhere, let alone the Supreme Court, that severely limits churches' freedom. He would say, along with Paul Marshall, another scholar who I included in the piece that I put up today, former colleague of mine with the Media Project, Paul says that, you know, just like churches have to obey fire codes, and if there are other safety issues that come along, churches' power can be limited. Their freedom of religion can be limited in the name of safety. You'll also remember that for years here, I've talked about the three principles that I was taught when I was doing my degree in church-state studies at Baylor University, that the government has a right to get involved in doctrine and worship and religious life on like three basic types of issues. One is fraud, one is profit, and the other is clear threat to life and health. Now, that last one is where we've had many, many important Supreme Court cases struggling with that, all the way down from Jehovah's Witnesses and blood transfusions to whether or not parents can exempt their children from medical care in the name of a belief in spiritual healing, and a lot of these things. Well, in my opinion, what we're dealing with now in the coronavirus era is churches are being asked to limit their absolute freedom to meet in collective worship. They're being asked to limit that in the name of health and clear threat to life and health. And in this case, we are talking not only about a clear threat to the life and health of the church members, we're talking about them walking outside and endangering their community through this activity. This has been documented in a number of cases that our listeners may have heard about. Many people believe that the explosion of cases in Louisiana can directly be related to Mardi Gras. In northern Italy, there was a soccer match at which an overwhelming number of the coronavirus cases have been linked to flowing out in spider webs of connections out of that soccer match. In one place up in Washington State, it came down to one choir. They decided to have a choir practice, and 60 people gathered for the choir practice. They cleaned their hands with Purell. They tried not to stand further apart, and still almost half the choir came down with the virus. And they've had two deaths in that choir already. So clearly we're dealing with something here that is a threat to life and health. If there are isolated and rare cases of evangelicals, Pentecostals, charismatics, whoever, who want to try to fight for an unlimited right of worship, David French, of course, who is a Harvard-level expert in First Amendment law and religious freedom, he is scared that we could conceivably get a court case here that's going to cost the church freedom instead of gaining it. Just like, you know, the famous Bob Jones case, when Bob Jones University was preventing interracial dating because of a doctrinal interpretation of the Bible there. I mean, and we ended up with the Bob Jones case that now, the minute the Supreme Court, if it ever does, makes the mystery of same-sex attraction, makes that equal to the genetic factor of race, Bob Jones could suddenly be justified to strip the tax exemption of churches, parachurch groups, and other stuff all over America. The more famous case, the Employment Division versus Smith in 1990, when conservatives on the court, in the name of limiting the use of drugs, this is, of course, the famous peyote case, whether people had a right to use a hallucinogenic drug during religious rituals that go back for centuries, This led to RFRA, to the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, and many of the debates that are going on right now in clashes between churches, religious organizations, religious people who own cake shops and, you know, flower stores and whatever else, florists. I mean, a lot of this grows out of that case, the arguments. So we could, if churches not careful here, we could end up with what would be a big story, and it would be a horrible one, if we ended up with some sort of case that further limited the freedom of churches in the name of attempting to protect it, if churches don't somehow cooperate with trying to stop this pandemic.
Where would you look in the media for the answer to the question, what kind of theology was driving Rodney Howard Brown to encourage his people to continue to gather en masse during a shutdown?
You know, that's a great question, but I don't have an answer, because you can find Pentecostal and charismatic believers whose theology should be similar to his or even identical to his who aren't doing this same thing. There's this whole world of what at one point in charismatic life was called power prophecy, and I think the emphasis here is on the word power. I think to some degree, this is saying, you know, we have an awesome God. Our God will do whatever we ask him to do. And the minute you say things like that, you're cutting ties to the Christianity of the past, where people prayed for protection, but they didn't tell God how those prayers were supposed to be answered. He's simply saying, God will protect us. I say he will protect us. You better believe he will protect us. Now everybody hug each other to prove, as one rather flamboyant image online that I saw today said, the stage after that involves Kool-Aid. Now, that's a rather radical statement to say it's time to drink the Kool-Aid. But in this case, we are talking about a life and death issue, maybe not one with a 100% kill rate. But if you put a bunch of people in a crowded place right now, whether it's an NBA game, a concert, you know, the Chinese New Year parades in those crowded streets of New York that the civic government failed to cancel, that I bet they now wish they could have canceled those, whether it's secular or whether it's sacred, lots of people in a jammed space right now is going to kill some people. To me, if that doesn't present a classic First Amendment clear threat to life and health limitation on absolute religious freedom, then I don't know what one would look like.
Okay, a couple more questions here before we wrap it up. An AP-style book kind of a question. How does a reporter describe something that may be common among evangelicals, rightly defined? What modifier does he use? Does he use some? Does he use a few? Yeah. What does he do?
Thank you for reminding me of that. We had an example of that I mentioned in my piece today, where I had praised the New York Times, but then I kind of jumped on a Bloomberg headline, which I think they thought they were being accurate and using the right modifier. And it said, some megachurches are still packing in crowds. Now, that's horribly vague. But on one level, it's hard to say that's wrong. There are some megachurches are packing in crowds. But then here's the irony. At the very end of that story, in the part where they're kind of balancing that message, it ends by saying a paragraph that begins with, some megachurches have opted out of in-person services and turned to live streaming entirely. Some and some. Doesn't that imply to you that it's kind of like approximately the same number?
Yes.
When in reality, what we're dealing with here is a few megachurches. And I would even say a few megachurch leaders, because these are almost universally the kind of independent churches where the pastor functions probably with more power than the Pope. You know, when it comes to saying what this church does or what it doesn't do. After reading that sentence and getting a little bit heated up, I started cruising around the internet looked up the top 25 biggest megachurches in America, visited a couple websites, and I couldn't find one of the large megachurches in America that isn't streaming services right now. And then all of the major Southern Baptist churches that were in that list are all streaming worship services right now. The independent Christian churches, the Campbellite kind of denomination that isn't a denomination, all of those churches that are among the biggest megachurches are streaming worship right now. From coast to coast, Catholic bishops, Orthodox bishops have been universal in their support of streaming worship services, or in a few cases, Catholics have actually closed the doors altogether and only let one or two churches stream. I think that's going too far myself. But the overwhelming evidence is that churches are cooperating with this. If you had tremendous resources for reporting the way the New York Times does, it would be interesting to do a more ambitious story about this. But I would have said in that headline, a few megachurch are still packing in the crowds, and then a handful even. That would take up a bit more space in a headline. And then in that last graph, it really should have said the overwhelming majority of megachurches and major denominations in America have opted out of in-person service and turned to live streaming entirely. And it would have only taken you about 5 to 10 minutes on the internet to have justified that stronger language. It would take a lot more time to do a definitive coast-to-coast study, but you could have scanned large churches and scanned large denominations and arrived at a stronger and more accurate statement with just a few clicks of a mouse.
Finally, with about 30 seconds, what do you expect the kind of hair-on-fire op-ed that we get from Catherine Stewart to do with a story like Rodney Howard Brown?
Well, I don't know. I don't want to speak for her. But it seems to me that exactly what David French is scared of is what you could also see in an op-ed, which is where you take what this guy is claiming as the rights of churches, and you say, this is what those crazy evangelicals and fundamentalists want. They want the right to practice their faith, even if it means killing you. And that's the sort of oversimplification that can get out of control and even end up in bad legal cases. It's happened before. It could happen again.
Terry Mattingly is senior fellow at the Overby Center at the University of Mississippi. He's author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion, and he is founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, thank you very much.
Glad to be here.
When we come back from this break, we're going to spend some time thinking about the church post-coronavirus. Dr. Ken Sherb will join us. He formerly served as an assistant to the president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod.
This week on The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, we're journeying on in Hebrews. Able to save to the uttermost, we have such a high priest. The new covenant, the replica of the reality and its meaning, and redemption and the blood. Join me, Pastor Will Whedon, for The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, your daily 15-minute verse-by-verse Bible study on demand at thewordendures.org and on the Lutheran Public Radio app.
After Jesus was baptized, the Holy Spirit drove him into the wilderness, and there he fasted for 40 days, and Satan came and tempted him. And whereas we have fallen to temptation time and again, Jesus did not. Read the March issue of the Luther Witness to learn all about fasting and temptation. Read about how God called his people to return to him with fasting, with weeping, and with mourning, and learn about how Jesus gives us his perfect obedience in place of our sin. Visit cph.org/witness to subscribe today. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran perspective. cph.org/witness.
St. Jacobi Lutheran Church in Shawnee, Wisconsin has a special guest each and every week. It isn't you, but it is Jesus Christ. He is a guest, and he is also the one who comes to serve you with his preached word and his broken body and shed blood. You are invited to be served by Jesus on Saturday evening at 6:30 and Sunday morning at 9 a.m. Visit www.stjakobi.org for more information.
Your church Easter egg hunt has been cancelled. But that doesn't mean there aren't wonderful treasures to be discovered at Ad Crucem. Celebrate your child's confirmation with Lutheran certificates, necklaces, and memory boxes, and wish all your loved ones a joyous, if socially distanced, Eastertide with our Christ-focused greeting cards. Put what you believe, teach, and confess on display with our Apostles' Creed, Nicene Creed, and Athanasian Creed. Visit adcrucem.com. That's adcrucem.com.
Your comprehensive source for information, teaching, and truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Lutheran Federal Credit Union serves the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod community with car and personal loans, mortgages, credit cards, checking and savings accounts. Lutheran FCU supports LCMS organizations with its Spotlight Ministry program, and Lutheran Federal Credit Union allows you to make purchases with Apple Pay, Google Pay, and Samsung Pay using your digital wallet. Learn more at LutheranFCU.org. Good for you, good for the church, Lutheran Federal Credit Union, LutheranFCU.org.